I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. Today, the theme is the environment, looking at it from a different perspective. We're going to look at the question that has been raised by at least a dozen highly respected environmental climatologist scientists. Are we approaching a breakdown in our systems? Do we have multiple feedback loops? Are we at tipping points? Is there anything that we as individuals, as governments, can do to slow it or reverse it? Or is it irreversible? Have we passed that point where we can make a difference? Systems do not all collapse at once. They do so by what is stressing the system at any given point. For example, if you live in Miami or Fort Lauderdale or anywhere on the west coast of Florida or the Keys, you're virtually at sea level. That means that if there is a storm surge, you're going to have greater flooding than if you lived, let's say, further inland, or if this were 20 years ago. I know that for a fact because I lived in Miami Beach on South Beach for almost 15 years. And I saw each morning, beginning about the seventh year I was there, that when the tide would go out in the morning, there would be seaweed that I could actually see, like there's an demarcation line in the sand. And it kept getting further and further and further inland until the year before I finally sold my place, it was up against the bottom of some of the buildings, swimming pools outside. I also saw something in the last 3 to 4 years I did not see earlier, and that was barges bringing in loads of sand, tractors leveling off the sand on the beach. When I asked the drivers what they were doing, they were saying, well, South Beach is losing a lot of sand, and we've run out of sand. In fact, there's no more sand in the United States or along the shoreline, so we have to go to other countries to get their sand, buy their sand, bring it in, so that when people go to a place like Miami Beach, they have a beach. Now, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, you don't think that there's going to be a complete disappearance of the beach, but that's exactly what is happening. So I ask a theoretical question. What would the beach look like today if you had not been replacing the sand each day for the last 10 years? And he said, there wouldn't be a beach here. It'd be just a rocky, rough terrain. You wouldn't be able to walk out on it and lay down or go into the water. Also, South Beach is very thin. In fact, between Ocean Drive, which is facing the Atlantic, and West Street or Alton Drive, which are the two roads facing the bay or downtown Miami, it's not very far. But at night, as the waves came in, the tidal waves came in, suddenly it would flood. I saw times when I would try to walk over there and couldn't. It would be 18 inches deep in water. So Miami put millions, I'm told, I'm not sure how accurate, over $220 million, into constructing large turbines that would pull in this water, suck it in, and then put it out into the bay. That's fine temporarily, but it makes no sense in the long term because whatever goes in the bay is going to go right back around and connect with the Atlantic. They're connected. It's not two separate situations. So it was a temporary patch. Now, in the end, I don't believe that Miami or most of the cities along the East Coast of the United States are going to have a quality of life. I believe that the ocean will come in, and I do not believe it's going to take a long time to do that. My guest is going to give his opinion in a moment. Now, my guest today is Professor Guy McPherson. He is Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He specialized in forest resources and energy decline and climate change and its economic consequences. He's also been on the faculty of Texas A&M and the University of California at Berkeley. He is also the author, along with Carolyn Baker, of Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, and he currently hosts a radio program on Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time called Nature Bats Last. Nice to have you with us today, Guy.
It's a pleasure to chat with you again, Gary. Thanks for the opportunity.
And Guy is now residing in Belize, and therefore we're hopeful that our connection will be all right. He is on Skype with us, I believe. Kai, I'm going to do a little extended introduction today before we come to you. So I just want to let our audience know that I'm going to be sharing some research that I did that I believe that the mainstream and alternative media, even those in the environmental movement, are not either aware of, or if they are aware, they're not adding an end to their syllabus when they talk about the environment. We have people talking like Bill McKibben that we should have a war on the environment. And we also have people such as Dr. Glenn Berry saying Bill's wrong, and a lot of other people who support that war on climate. And I support Glenn Berry on this because where did our war on poverty, our war on drugs, our war on cancer, our war on terrorism, where did that end up? Nowhere beneficial. And so we're going to give more positive and, I believe, constructive ways of dealing with the environment. But I wanted to give you some of my research for the general audience. And then if you would, please take each part of this that you feel is relevant that you want to address, Guy, and do so, all right?
Yes, that would be awesome. Thanks.
First, I want to talk about what I'm most concerned about. And I've been researching this for the last 9 years, preparing for a major book on the subject and also a film. Normally, it doesn't take me 9 years to do a film. But everything keeps changing so radically so that had I done, let's say, the film on the part of the film dealing with glaciers, we didn't have 80% loss of glaciers, let's say, 10 years ago. Today we do. So that changes the calculus on this. So we have what are called tipping points. Now, what this means is that there's a point to which something is so altered that it cannot be reversed by any means. And those are deadly. But they're not in any one given place impacting every place, so therefore people tend not to notice it. Example, if you are a person living in, let's say, Scottsdale, Arizona, you don't have to worry about a tidal wave. You don't have to worry about a lot of the problems, ecological problems, environmental problems other people do. But if you live, let's say, in San Francisco or anywhere on the West Coast, clear up to Vancouver in British Columbia, you do have to worry about an earthquake because there's one coming. We just don't know when, but we know that the last one came, produced a gigantic tsunami, probably the largest wave to ever hit the coast of America. Today, that would wipe out over 1 million people. So it's not, are these things going to happen? It's when, and can we predict them? Now, I interviewed the man that there's a real-life character based upon the Jeff Goldblum person in Jurassic Park who is what is known as a chaos theorist. And he said, we're in chaos theory now, meaning there is no accurate way to predict when some of these tipping points will tip or the consequences. I'll give you an example. We are told that it'll be 100 to 200, even 500 years before the water increases to the point where it will actually make a difference. That's the mainstream media. Many of the climatologists and scientists and government officials say, you see, we really don't have to worry. And that's certainly what a lot of the climate deniers have suggested. It's going to be so far in the future. It's 20 generations out. So we don't have to be upsetting all of our commerce and factories and firing people because we had to put in costly improvements. However, here's where we're in chaos. There is an iceberg attached to land. It will not increase the water because it's like having ice in a glass that melts, doesn't increase the volume of the water. It's called the Larsen Sea Shelf. Now, the Larsen Sea Shelf is the size of Delaware. It is, without question, the largest single iceberg ever recorded. It's over 130 miles long, over 3/4 mile deep, and over 300 feet wide. And there's a crack that is clearly visible, and it's now within hours to days from reaching its final point where it will simply crack and break off. In and of itself, that is not a major disaster. And people shrug their shoulders and say, so what? I'm going to go to my gym, I'm going to go play tennis, I'm going to go have dinner, I'm going to go to a movie. It doesn't impact me. And they are correct. Except that Larsen B. Shelf was holding back, backstopping a major part of the glacier on Antarctica that holds the greatest amount of water, fresh water in the world. Now, since there's nothing holding it back, it will begin to calve. The calving is what you see where it breaks off and falls in the ocean, except rather than 50-foot by 100-foot section dropping off and falling in the water, we're talking massive amounts, amounts of calving we've never seen. Also, it's not flat. There's a substantial angle, meaning here's the water, here's the glacier. The glacier is now going to go right into the water. There's nothing stopping. Just visualize yourself on the backside of a door, and there's a storm outside, and you're holding the door from blowing open. Okay, you hold it, good. Now let's say that you are pushed back. The door swings open. Everything comes in. So now we have no way in the world, no human being, no calculus can say how much ice is going to break off in what period of time and go into the water. That will increase the world's water. And there are satellites that measure the total fluidity of the planet every month. And we're seeing a shift, mainly because of Greenland, but also now, once Larsen B. Sea Shelf is gone, Antarctica. That's a tipping point. So once Larsen B. Shelf is gone, there will be a tipping point. And then there are other consequences to that when you have that much fresh water going in and mixing with the saltier water, a mixing of warm and cold water. All this has its own dynamics that impact. No one's paying attention. So that's what I mean about tipping points. So melting of the Arctic ice cap, this tipping point is already passed. There was a time when the sun would come down, hit the snow, hit the ice, bounce back rather harmlessly into the atmosphere. The Arctic is not deep. In some places, it's 500 feet. That's real shallow. And it holds one of the largest amounts of methane in the world. Now, methane can be released relatively harmlessly when it's not released all at once. We're looking at giga amounts of methane coming up. That, in turn, will continue the heating of the atmosphere, which means that more ice will melt. Now, look at the consequences. Let's say you say, well, okay, I don't live near the ocean, Gary. I'm living in Las Vegas. Where do you get your water? You have no natural aquifer. It comes from Little Colorado. 39 million Americans get their water from Little Colorado. The Colorado gets its water from the melting mountains. And if the mountains are too warm, if there's been so much heat that you can no longer pack 15 foot of ice onto a mountain that it melts gradually over a period of months and releasing water so it fills the aquifer and fills the Hoover Dam, the Lake Mead and these other reservoirs, where are you getting your water? You're going to be out of water. So I'm projecting that 20 states will be so water challenged that they can no longer support all the industry, people, and agriculture that historically they've been able to do. So they're going to have to make choices. Well, if your tax base comes from real estate taxes, and if your real estate is plunging down because it's not worth anything, if you don't provide water to a house, the house has no water, no value. So then how are you going to pay for roads and police and fire and schools, libraries? You'll be hard put. So that's the power of a tipping point, and we're not looking at that. A few others, Greenland. Greenland could raise the water by 20 feet if it became free, and you say, well, that's not going to happen for a long time. Not true. Greenland now has thousands and thousands of lakes in the summertime, and some of these lakes now are going straight down. They're leaking straight down the bottom, creating a skid, pulling the ice into the ocean. You have the disintegration of the West Antarctic ice sheet. You have loss of glaciers. You have fresh water from Arctic and Greenland collapsing the Gulf Stream. You have El Nino becoming a permanent climate fixture. You have disruption of the Indian, West African monsoons. You have melting permafrost and tundra releasing vast quantities of methane, which is clathrate, which has a gun effect. You have desertification. In fact, we never hear about it. But China only has one half of its rivers that can even be used for agriculture. They're so polluted. But also, a lot of them are drying up. They also have more cities and towns and villages that have been overtaken by the desert that they no longer are habitable. Over 22,000 places where people lived. We'll hear about their phantom cities, their skyscrapers, all true. but you're not hearing about what's encroaching on the spaces that used to be viable living spaces. So we have massive desertification. We have the Arctic ozone hole, and we also, that could mean that not plants, animals, or humans could live directly in an ozone hole area. You'd burn to death, or not burn to death, you'd have third-degree burns in 10 minutes. You have the loss of the rainforest, the great lungs of the planet, especially in New Guinea and the Amazon. You have the loss of the boreal forest, which is a more recent tipping point. So those are all tipping points that the average person is not aware of, that are crucial, and all of those are tipping. So, Guy, would you start, please, by giving us your assessment of what it means when these tip, how many of them have tip, and how long do you believe it will be before the consequences of their tipping start to ricochet out into other areas of our life? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. First, I want to comment on a few of the phenomena you already mentioned. For example, you mentioned seawater rise and its impacts in South Florida. Well, the impact is already being felt, not in the form of people drowning, not in the form of buildings going underwater, but primarily in the form of seawater intrusion into the fresh water that people in that area drink. So they drilled down into the freshwater lens, and that freshwater has been intruded upon by salt water as a result of sea level rise and the increased push from salt water, from seawater into that freshwater lens. So now we have brackish water that is increasingly difficult to make potable for people to drink. You mentioned the Larsen C ice shelf. Well, the last week in May, according to USA Today, hardly a left-wing liberal source, according to USA Today, a massive crack in the Larsen C grew 11 miles in the final week of May. That leaves only 8 miles remaining in the 120-mile crack until it's done, until it's completely separated from the rest of the ice. And as you indicated, that's not going to cause sea level rise itself. This process is known as calving. But once the iceberg breaks off, it will fundamentally change the landscape of the Antarctic Peninsula. And most notably, that Larsen C ice shelf is holding back a tremendous number of glaciers that feed the ice shelf. So once they disappear, once the Larsen C goes, ice can flow much faster from land to the ocean and contribute very quickly to sea level rise. That's happening right now. That's, you know, that's as little as a week, a month. It's hard to say how long before the Larsen C goes completely and those freshwater glaciers begin dumping into the ocean and contributing to sea level rise. Finally, you also mentioned the loss of habitat in the interior of large continents due to lack of potable water and also due to lack of food. Already around the world, we're experiencing events that people predicted would not happen for another 100 years. We're getting the dust storms that never, ever happened previously, most notably in North America. The term haboob used to be restricted to the Indian subcontinent. It was not a North American phenomenon at all. And within the last 5 years, it's become common phrase to refer to the storms that are afflicting, most notably around Phoenix, Arizona, for example, as haboobs. Yes, they're happening right now. The climate has changed, the weather has changed, and we are in the arena right now of abrupt climate change. We're in the early stages of abrupt change. And already we're seeing seawater intrusion into freshwater lenses that used to provide water in coastal areas. We're already seeing the cracking and the near-term dissolution of the Larsen C ice shelf. And we're already seeing loss of habitat in America and the Middle East, where people have become climate change refugees. Another example of climate change refugees is in the South Pacific, where sea level change has caused them to... They have lost habitat. They have lost the ability to grow food in the South Pacific. These are the things that are going on right now. How soon until it affects people in the Great Lakes region? How soon before it affects people in the Pacific Northwest? I don't know, but I suspect it will be far faster than we are being told by the mainstream press, in fact, who have only come to grips with linear or gradual climate change. I think these changes are already underway. I think in many cases, the superstorms of my grandchildren, the James Seven book, are already upon us. We have gone from Katrina being a rare event in 2005 to Katrina-like storms being an annual event in Haiyan and Ike and Isaac, and the list goes on and on. So I don't think we have long before it becomes obvious, even to the climate that is underway and is already impacting the part of the area you live, because the part of the area you live, even though it's been spared so far, is certainly not guaranteed to be spared.
Guy, we realize how severe this is when we go back and look at Hurricane Sandy. That was a Category 1. Imagine if that had been a Category 5. Katrina was a Category 3 when it hit the land. It was Category 5 before then, but it was a 3, and it didn't hit New Orleans directly. It veered. Could you imagine a Category 5 hitting New Orleans directly? Could you imagine Category 5 hitting the New York area directly? We're talking about massive destruction of life and property, and into the hundreds of billions of dollars, and that is the new norm. One point that we should realize: this past year, we've had more than 12,000 exceptional weather events in the United States, more than 110,000 worldwide. One example. We now have flooding in towns that have never flooded before. Upstate New York, in Vermont, in West Virginia, in Wisconsin, as just some examples. And that's because the amount of rain that is coming when it comes is so incredibly more voluminous than what it has in the past, that the banks overflow, levees overflow, dams overflow, dams break, bridges are washed away, and lives are destroyed. We look at Louisiana. Louisiana had the worst storm in its history. In fact, it was called a once-in-500-year storm. The trouble is there were seven of these once-in-500-year storms that we experienced not over 500 years, all within a year. In Louisiana, they had flooding everywhere, what they call a parish, other states call a county. And in just one parish, they had over 67,000 homes that were affected. Now, the problem is that because there was no flooding before, no one had flood insurance. And without flood insurance, these people didn't have the means to go in and, to an effect, clear out all the flood-damaged material. And if you don't do that quickly, you get mold. And some of this mold is so dangerous that it can kill people. So then the state and the county health authorities, rightly so, say this house is contaminated and you have to have it professionally decontaminated. Person says, well, I don't have the money to do that. And the state says, well, you can't go back in. Well, where do I live? What about my clothes, the food I had? What about all the things, my possessions? Sorry, that's it. So outside of showing people for a day or two going to Red Cross centers or to some public shelter, we forget these people exist. Well, if you have 67,000 homes and in one populous county, parish, and you have, let's say, an average of 4 people per home, you're talking about a huge number of people who now the world has forgotten, but they still exist. And the damage still exists. Katrina's damage still exists. I was down there recently filming in the lower Ninth Ward. There were some nice homes. Brad Pitt, to his credit, and I commend him for it, and Habitat for Humanity, and I credit them, rebuilt, you know, some homes. On one street, I saw seven homes. But then I couldn't drive down streets. I had to get out and walk with my camera down streets because there were giant potholes. The damage was still there. I went into houses that had no floors. The people still live there because no other place to live. And, you know, when you look through a glass, let's say a window, and the sun comes through and the prism of that refractory allows you to see all these little dust particles in the air that you otherwise wouldn't see. Well, imagine living on a dirt floor where you have to live and you have a bed. That dirt is constantly in the air. Its health impacts upon a person's lung, breathing in that dirt and clay, is horrific. Nothing being done about it. And we're not talking about a few people or a few thousand people. We're talking about tens of thousands of people. So I'm seeing all of these events happen, and I'm not seeing, we're looking at it and saying, wow, what can we do? I'm going to get to that in a few moments. But I'd like for you to give us what you consider the most realistic scenario of the most serious consequences to our hubris and our indifference that you see the possibilities happening, the likelihood of it happening, how it happens, and what will be the consequences based upon where you live to this happening.
Yeah, that's a fine question. And every time I am presenting, every time I'm on tour, I get a similar question. That is, for me, right here in the town of St. Louis, Missouri, for example, what are the impacts on me? When will I feel them? Well, I moved here to Belize. I arrived on July 20th of last year, and I was greeted 2 weeks later by Hurricane Earl, a Category 1 storm, and the eye went right over where I live in western Belize in the Maya Mountains. Nobody died in Belize. More than 40 people died in Mexico when Earl turned north and wreaked havoc in that region. Why are we seeing more of this? Well, for every 1 degree Celsius global average rise in temperature, there's 7% more moisture in the atmosphere. Most of that moisture goes into the upper troposphere, and that is the fastest self-reinforcing feedback loop. The equilibrium between moistening of the troposphere, or what we think of as relative humidity in the atmosphere, the equilibrium between that moisture and global average temperature is reached within a matter of days, maybe a week. So it's a very, very fast feedback. So the faster we heat up the planet, the more moisture increases in the atmosphere. That contributes to continual heating of the planet, which contributes to more evaporating or more moistening of the upper troposphere system now. We have more energy, and particularly in the ocean, where more than 90% of the carbon dioxide and more than 90% of the heating so far has been stored is in the world's oceans. So that energy is looking for some place to go. Waves are forecast to batter the Arctic Ocean up to 7.5 feet high tomorrow. That's the ocean, which is surrounded by continents that act as shields against the winds. Temperatures are forecast to be as high as 105 degrees in Phoenix, Arizona, and nearly 80 degrees in Alaska. And so that warm land temperature is being blown out into the Arctic Ocean. The Arctic Ocean is heating up as a result of carbon dioxide accumulating and heat accumulating on Earth over the course of the last 265 years during the Industrial Revolution. So those high waves are battering the ocean, and it looked to me like there's a very, very high probability of an ice-free Arctic this summer. And it could easily happen early this summer. I don't think we will have an ice-free Arctic waiting until September. Low-level ice in the Arctic occurs in late September, coincident with the first day of autumn in the Northern Hemisphere. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think instead we will have an ice-free Arctic in July or August. I'd say there's at least a 50% chance that's going to happen in July or August, not wait until September.
And what will that cause?
The kind of heating this planet has never experienced. Methane being released from this relatively shallow subfloor of the Arctic Ocean, which you already mentioned, it's sometimes less than 500 feet. It's sometimes less than 200 feet. And those methane hydrates are sitting there at the relatively shallow depth. We get rid of that ice cover, the ocean is going to heat up very, very rapidly, and methane is going to start spewing out of the Arctic Ocean like we've never seen. We haven't had an ice-free Arctic in human history. It's been 3 million years since we had an ice-free Arctic. We can't even forecast what that's going to look like in terms of methane emissions, but I guarantee that it's going to be catastrophic. The methane emissions are going to be absolutely accelerating, as they have within the last few years. It's going to be accelerating as well beyond the point we have observed so far. In addition, the lack of albedo associated with the disappearing of that Arctic ice is going to be catastrophic, whereas previously we've had most or at least much of the incoming solar radiation reflected back out into space because of the ice in the Arctic. Now, with an ice-free Arctic, we're going to have a blue ocean event, and that moisture, that heat is going to be trapped by the Arctic Ocean, by the blue ocean, instead of being bounced back into space. And the consequences are absolutely surreal. For example, Peter Wadhams, in his work from 2012, so this goes back 5 years now, Peter Wadhams pointed out that absorption of energy has already increased from 0.43 watts per square meter over the whole planet between 1970 and 1992 to 0.75 watt per square meter since 1992. And Wadhams concludes that the energy absorption for the whole planet will increase by more than 2 watts per square meter. That's more than double what we're at right now over the entire globe, just as a result of the loss of ice in the Arctic. That doesn't even touch the methane. That's just heating directly as a result of an ice-free Arctic. And then the methane that will be spewing out of the Arctic adds even more disaster to the abrupt climate change that we are in the early stages of right now.
Guy, let me give a few examples of what you're suggesting in real practical and pragmatic terms. As an organic farmer, as an instructor in farming and beehive maintenance and ecology, there are certain principles. Seeds are extremely vulnerable. Seeds cannot germinate in some radical way if the environment changes radically. So if you put seeds in a ground and have them germinate and suddenly it gets so hot that the seeds' genetics can't adapt, they die. So what you would have is a massive die-off of most of the different type of seedlings that we have. It'd be too hot. Or on the other side of that, if you have El Nino events and you have excessive rain pouring in certain areas, trees like fruit trees are very vulnerable to root rot. So the roots would begin to rot because there's too much water, and many plants would simply rot. And in effect, the plant would drown. And we're already seeing this. Here's the issue with this. Nobody wants this to happen. But it is happening. It has been happening. But as long as you're the wealthiest nation in the world, you can afford to buy what you had destroyed in your own Kansas or Texas or Florida. You can buy that same product elsewhere. We can get cherries from South Africa in the winter when we otherwise wouldn't have them, coming from Michigan and the Pacific Northwest. We can get apples from South America. We can get all of our fruits from South America. Our winter is their summer. So because of the ability to pay higher prices you can buy them. Now, even in New York City, there are stores where you get your highest premium produce. You pay more for it. And for the lower premium, you pay less. And if you don't have, let's say, what is grown except for locally, you have a substantial reduction in what is available. We're used to going into a store and suddenly there's, you know, 400 items we can buy that are fresh. That's going to disappear substantially. Not completely, again, because collapse does not happen all at once. It's like an economic collapse. For the 8 million millionaires, they'll be slightly hurt. For those who are billionaires, not hurt at all. For those who are the super rich but not billionaires, they're not going to be affected. For the conservative financial, let's say, working class that are retiring or retired, they won't really be hurt as long as they continue not creating debt and living off their savings. That leaves about 65 million people who will not be adversely affected. It means everyone else will be. So when you look at how many people are going to be hurt when they cannot afford higher prices for food, you're looking at over 250 million Americans. And you're looking at over 60 million of those people who are 18 or under. So you're looking at a lot of seniors and a lot of young people who couldn't afford food because they're on strict limitations. And in fact, right now, 50% of all Americans who are retiring have less than $10,000 to their name. That's after working a whole lifetime. And we have over 100 million that don't have $500 in the bank. So they literally have to live week to week. Now, throw into this that you can't grow crops. You don't have the wheat that make the bread and the cereals. You don't have the soy. You don't have the high-protein substances. You don't have the vegetables because it was too hot. We're not looking at this, and we should be. Your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I had a conversation with the tribe where I live in Belize. There are 8 adults and 2 approximately teenage kids living on the 57 acres in western Belize in the Maya Mountains. And we had a conversation yesterday that ran for about 2 hours about exactly what we're talking about today. For the most part, these are very hardworking people who haven't had an opportunity to keep up with the information because the standard work week here is 48 hours. People get Sundays off and spend the time with their family. So we had a long-ranging conversation about what the future might well hold for relatively poor people who depend upon their skills in growing food to get by. And that's a majority of the people in this country, in Belize. And it was not a conversation that I was looking forward to. I don't enjoy telling people what the evidence indicates the future is going to look like. But I think people have a right to know what the future is likely to look like in the midst of climate change. And here that means the inability to grow corn. We had an absolutely devastating drought over the course of the last 2 years that made it impossible for the corn to mature to harvest. One of the people who works on the property is a grower, and he lost 5,600 tomato plants last year when Hurricane Earl hit. He lost more than 3,000 tomato plants this year because of the ongoing drought. These are the conversations that we need to have. They're difficult conversations to have. I will grant you that. Nobody wants to have the conversation. I will grant you that. That doesn't mean we need to turn away. That doesn't mean we can act like it's only going to affect other people when it's already affecting other people. And if you're paying attention, it's already affecting you. It might not be affecting the uber wealthy, as you point out, but it will. It might not be affecting the millionaires just yet because they haven't noticed the increased price of food and the increased difficulty of getting water through their taps, but they will. The time when everybody notices is coming in the very, very near future.
How near do you?
I don't see
how
any
near
way around that? Now is the
Guy, how? Give us your timetable for when you start to see the collapsing systems. And the feedback loops, the positive feedback loops, the negative feedback loops, and the tipping points, give us your best guesstimate of when you see this beginning.
If we have an ice-free Arctic summer, the first time in human history.
This summer.
And at this point, it would surprise me if we didn't have an ice-free Arctic. Yes. If that happens, then certainly by next spring, we will have a virtual inability to grow grains in the Northern Hemisphere. Certainly at the kind of scale we've been growing them for the last 50 years.
That's 10 months.
Period.
That's when it starts. The system again. It's like cancer. Nobody just wakes up one morning and has cancer and dies later in the afternoon. It takes decades to develop that cancer, and then we create the wrong approach to it. So you're saying that we have gone so far in being negligent, so far with hubris, so far living in denial because nobody wanted to challenge a corporation or the politicians didn't want to challenge their government to say, here's a mandate. We have to stick to it. We must make these changes. And because of this, we only see some countries like Norway and Sweden and Switzerland and Denmark are doing some positive things. And there is a movement on the part of some, but I'm going to get to that later, by Al Gore and others, Bill McKibben. But that's the commercialization of the environmental movement, in my opinion. And what we're not doing, we're not looking at massive growing of greens. In other words, in every state, growing 100 million new trees and millions of shrubs, putting people to work, giving them a living wage, securing carbon sinks. Because the one thing we can do that could make a difference immediately and individually is we can start to grow plants. That's a big thing. Instead, we're not doing anything. We're allowing more and more plants to be destroyed every day. And also, we could go vegan by just doing that one simple act, something that doesn't require government, doesn't require Paris Accords, which was voluntary. And I was opposed to, by the way, but not for the reasons that most people would think, because it was an illusion that it would cause the environment to be saved. And as you're showing, we don't have that time anymore. We don't have 30 years and 10 years for India and China not to be held accountable. We have to do things right now. So if we went vegan and we also began to grow enormous amounts of plants, we could begin to make a difference in some places, not everywhere. And especially in the Middle East, where they're not doing anything, they're just importing because of their wealth in Bahrain, because of wealth in Kuwait and Qatar and Saudi Arabia. They can afford to buy billions of dollars worth of food for their country each year. But the places they historically purchase it from themselves are going to be adversely affected. So you're looking at the desertification, the overheating of the entire Middle East. We're talking about from Israel and Turkey and Oman and Jordan, Lebanon. All of those countries in the Middle East are going to be so racked by environmental destruction, overheating, and loss of water. And that's what actually precipitated the crisis in Syria. It wasn't political. There was no civil war in Syria. That's a myth. It was because Syria was the breadbasket of that area of the world, and they had four consecutive years of severe drought. Farmers just didn't have the water to grow the crops, and that caused food shortages, caused hunger. And then there were local and legitimate protests. And then that was used as the ploy to start regime change. That's a separate issue. But you're looking at a major part of the world that is getting so hot, and they are not going to be able to grow stuff, and they haven't built sustainable environments. They just used, as they historically do, they use their oil wealth for weapons. They'll spend hundreds of billions of dollars on weapons, and they won't build infrastructure like hydroponics or other ways of feeding their people. So I think we're going to see food riots. When people can't afford to eat, when people are starving, when children are starving, people are going to react. And we've never seen that in the United States. I believe in the next 5 years, in parts of the United States where people are so deprived of food that you'll see food riots in the United States. Your thoughts?
I'd be very surprised if it takes that long, to be honest. The U.S. Naval Postgraduate College predicted an ice-free Arctic in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. We have dodged the bullet four times. I don't see us dodging the bullet this year, maybe next year. And that means loss of habitat, probably essentially throughout the globe, certainly over at least 90% of the globe, and within a matter of months, the ice-free Arctic visits us. So I think, I don't want to sound like a harbinger of doom here, like a gloom center, but the inability to grow food is already impacting us. The United States sold its grain reserves during the global financial crisis of 2008-2009. We don't have any storage at this point, and we are on the verge of being unable to produce grains at large scale in the interior of large continents in the Northern Hemisphere, and that's game over. That civilization comes to an abrupt close if there is no ability to store and distribute food in the form of grains in a relatively abrupt period of time. And we're talking not just relatively abrupt, we're talking about a matter of months, certainly no more than a couple of years before the whole system collapses under the weight of its own hubris. And most people don't have any understanding that we're on the brink because of the information put out by the mainstream media and the governments that we continue stubbornly to support. It's a tragedy.
Guy, we look forward to our next conversation. I really hope that you're 100% wrong, that I'm 100% wrong, and the other 12 to 15 environmentalists and conservationists and climate scientists are all wrong. Let us hope that. But thus far, everything I see by methodically putting the different pieces together, I'm seeing a whole picture. And I believe that one of the things we're missing are those scientists who look for the entire picture. They may be correct and very cautious about their own particular piece of puzzle they're controlling, but they're not putting it all together. And when you put it all together, you see something that really is scary. Guy McPherson, Guy down in Belize. We look forward to our next conversation. Thank you. To finish off our program, I would like to share some insights. They're both constructive and positive, so that we don't feel overwhelmed. I do not believe that our government is capable at this time, nor anywhere in the future, based upon the power that the corporate interests have over those government officials and our government policy on the environment, to make the type of changes that would cause a major shift away from these terrible tipping points. But I do believe and have a great deal of confidence that individuals can and should become completely engaged in trying to do things at the local level. For example, at the local level, you can support those foundations and environmental groups that are doing good work, that are getting out there, for example, and getting church groups or civic organizations or wealthy individuals to donate to planting trees. That's something we can do. That is completely within our power. So if we begin to plant thousands of trees per city, and individuals are actually doing this, that's what we need. We need these carbon sinks, and we need a lot of them. So the more that we protect our existing forests, the more we emphasize legislation to keep corporations from exploiting any more of these logging operations in the great forests, especially the northwestern part of the United States, in Oregon, Washington, and California. So that's a big plus. So support organizations that are supporting stopping deforestation. Also support those organizations in, for example, Belize and in Brazil that are also stopping the deforestation of the great lungs of the planet in the Amazon and reforestation. So we can plant a lot. Also, I believe that the most important single thing we could do to help turn around the environment, in addition to planting more green, more trees, more shrubs, is to go vegan, a healthy plant-based diet. That represents upwards of anywhere, depending upon the country, of 13 to 18% of global warming's contribution is from methane, which is from animals. So if we stopped raising these animals for human consumption, not only are we going to help the planet, we're going to help our own health. Also, go local. You're lowering carbon footprint, which is lowering global warming, when you are purchasing things that are locally grown, and then try to get more people back to the land. Now, those are the things that I find are responsible and reasonable. What I'm opposed to at this moment is putting all of the emphasis upon organizations that are out there that are successful, that are very well funded, that have a lot of celebrities, and that really only see a part of the puzzle. Now, I absolutely support solar. I support wind, especially with the new turbines. They don't have the big giant turbine paddles on them, and some of them don't have that at all, and hence they're not killing birds, they're not making noise, they're not an environmental blight, even as they produce electricity. But I also believe we should be supporting in our energy requirements from wave power, which is non-polluting, and from geothermal, which is non-polluting. So those are extra things. And then my final thought is we should be listening to people such as Dr. Glenn Berry. Here's what Glenn Berry has to say on this issue. This is an article called Bill McKibben's Ecology-Free Declaration of War on the Climate is Dangerous and Wrong. Why does Bill McKibben's recent sensationalistic appeal for a war on the climate make no mention, not even one, of ecology or ecosystems, while understanding Mr. McKibben is trying to call for a rapid societal response at a massive scale to an urgent existential threat? Perhaps a better analogy would be demobilization to make climate peace by cutting emissions and reforesting, as declarations of war often only make things worse. It is irresponsible and contrary to established ecological science for Mr. McKibben to promote a war on climate focused solely upon techno-optimistic industrial solutions. First and foremost, climate change is an ecological issue. I, for one, am much less perturbed that Bill occasionally uses plastic bags for his groceries than that he apparently has little understanding of the ecological systems that maintain a livable Earth. Climate policies matter. We have very few chances to get it right before abrupt climate change and related environmental and social issues collapse the biosphere. Yet the solutions being put forth by the leading climate scientists, including Bill McKibben, Al Gore, Leonardo DiCaprio, Naomi Klein, and Michael Brun, are woefully inadequate. In fact, their lack of ecological focus is dangerous and wrong and virtually ensures failure in limiting global warming to an acceptable level. Mr. McKibben states, quote, we're under attack from climate change, and our only hope is to mobilize like we did in World War II. Well, the colorful essay correctly notes the urgency of a drastic, urgent, and large-scale response to the threats posed by climate change. Yet we are led to falsely believe that a war-like industrial retooling to produce massively more solar panels and wind turbines more quickly will provide adequate solutions to climate change. At best, this is meaningless jargonism. At its worst, it's dangerously misdiagnosed climate change causes and does not propose ecologically sufficient climate change solutions. Not even once does Bill's essay call for a war on climate mention the biological and ecological aspects of our climate change conundrum. In fact, the words ecology, ecosystem, and even environment are not even used, not once. Natural, and here's what's important, natural ecosystem loss as a cause and positive feedback results of abrupt climate change is once again given short shrift. Protecting and enhancing the natural environment are amazingly completely ignored yet again by Mr. McKibben as an element of climate solutions. Instead, we are led to war metaphors and further industrial development as a dangerously incomplete climate policy. What the hell, Bill? Where is your understanding of ecology and your embrace of widespread and connected natural ecosystems as a critical element of any climate change solution? It's one thing to make reference to ecosystems and climate in books, and another matter to campaign on the issue. Why doesn't 350.org actively support and campaign upon ending old-growth forest logging as a central solution to climate change? Mr. McKibben, climate change is not Hitler, and waging war will not solve it. Climate change results not only from billions of pistons burning fossil fuels It's also caused by billions of conscious decisions to destroy the naturally evolving world, one tree or patch of ground at a time, which through vegetation's recycling of water, energy, and carbon have sustained habitable Earth for eons. Of course, at some level, Bill, you must realize this. But why not speak right and advocate for protecting and restoring natural ecosystems as a key to climate change? Maintaining natural stores of carbon and natural carbon cycles between these repositories is of primary importance in limiting abrupt climate change and ensuring it doesn't become runaway. Mr. McKibben's vision of a warlike industrial mobilization is myopic and entirely ignores the reengineering of land and water that must occur. We could end fossil fuel emissions rapidly and still drown in historical emissions if there are not ways to remove what we already have been emitting into the atmosphere. And we are over 400 parts per million of carbon, and the name of Bill's group, 350.org, acknowledges we have surpassed the safe limit. How else but through natural processes associated with plant growth will global ecological balance be restored? The simple ecological truth is that natural vegetation and their soil hold, buffer, and cycle carbon in a manner that removes carbon from the atmosphere. We know much about carbon, how it's released when natural vegetation is cleared and reduced, and there is tremendous potential to revegetate the vast areas of land that have been cleared of natural ecosystems, as nearly 90% of primary forest have been destroyed or dramatically diminished through fragmentation. All remaining old-growth forests must be protected not only as carbon stores, but also for sources of seed and genetic variability for the coming age of ecosystem restoration and climate adaptation and aiding to expand and reconnect, along with secondary forests undergoing succession into old-growth status, and intermixed with organic permaculture and forest gardens, expanding natural forest ecosystems have drastic potential to store carbon and perhaps more importantly, keep it recycling. Of course, old-growth forests provide innumerable other ecological services, including biodiversity, wildlife habitat, soil creation, water sponge, and genetic repository. Given how many natural terrestrial ecosystems have been lost, it is vital to avoid a willful ecocide that we stop logging ancient old-growth forests, allowing them to recover. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to our Progressive Commentary Hour. A lot more coming on upcoming programs. Have a nice day.